Hello, I'm Bob O'Neill, Executive Director of ICMA, and welcome to the Leading Ideas Series. We're here today to talk about the future of local government, and I would like to thank our partners at the Alliance for Innovation who've been involved in a project called The Next Big Thing. And so I've gathered a group of my colleagues to have a conversation today about local government, the future of local government, communities, and the impact on the profession. So thank you for joining us today for this conversation. We will take questions during the course of the webinar, and so if you have a question, you can contact us at hashtag ICMANBT or nextbigthing@icma.org. So I'd like to just introduce my panel, an interesting group of people who I think will have, I hope, a very stimulating conversation to prompt your questions. On my far right is Rebecca Ryan, the CEO of Next Gen Consulting and the resident futurist of the profession and of local government, who works with the Alliance for Innovation very closely. John Nalbandian, the person. John is the professor emeritus at the University of Kansas, well known to all of us in local government, probably one of the leading experts on local government and particularly the impact of city management on communities. Shannon Flanagan Watson, who is the assistant county manager in Arlington County, Virginia. And last but certainly not least is Mark Ott, the city manager of Austin, Texas. So thank you for joining the conversation today. And let me begin by just asking Rebecca, you've been involved in the project that the Alliance for Innovation has been engaged in called The Next Big Thing. Could you talk a little bit about the project?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So the Alliance, you know, they do such a great job of bringing these innovative city and county managers together. And this is a project to really sharpen their point of view. What can we expect in the next 20 to 50 years? What will be the key issues facing local government? And how can we help our members address those things head on, you know, with the typical courage and innovation that are typical of those members?
Well, great. And I hope you'll share some of your early findings with us.
And, yes, of course.
And hopefully some of this conversation will help enrich the work that you're doing. So I'd like to start with a question about what are the major forces and drivers that are going to impact local government over the next decades? Anybody want to start?
Sure.
Shannon, please.
I will. I think one of the most significant factors and drivers impacting local government and local government in general today is the declining public trust mm-hmm. in government. And we've seen that play out at the federal level, the state level, and I think increasingly so at the local government level, not only in conversations as part of the election cycle, but in our day-to-day work as we're implementing programs and services.
Mm-hmm. What else?
You know, I think that's a tough challenge because I think the nature of work necessarily is changing, and it doesn't look like what people necessarily think it looks like, and particularly when you consider the multi-generational nature of our workforce. Mm-hmm. And so we have, you know, we have millennials and X and Ys mm-hmm. and all of that stuff, and they all think and do things differently. They even look differently, mm-hmm. and they talk about things in context of thought design and doing experiments. Well, mm-hmm. The taxpaying public has a hard time with governments talking about doing experiments, but it's exactly the kind of thinking right. that we need to deal with some of the issues today.
Right. Yeah, like today we had a Twitter hashtag,
right?
And we had an email address for questions.
Yes, we did.
You know, it's like a right. perfect
exactly.
sort of generational mashup, right?
Right. right.
So what about what about the demographics?
Mm. Demographics are going to be huge, I think. I think especially the baby boom generation. I think their attitude about the future is going to be very important. I think grown up, very optimistic. About things, and now I'm thinking as we move into our elder years, there might be some concerns about direction that things are going, and so the idea of the role that the past will play in charting the future, mm-hmm. I think, is going to be absolutely crucial to the investment that that the older people have.
John, do you think that the generations are going to sort of see the exercise as a zero-sum game? You either win or lose rather than sort of what I would call the community of interest?
I think it depends a whole lot on how the politics of identity play themselves out, play itself out. Issues of identity are fueled by emotion, and it's just, I think, for a baby boom generation, I think their identity, by and large, is found in the past. It's found in what we have accomplished, what we have done. And to the extent that that past is not respected, then there's going to be some divide. At the same time, there is an obligation for those of us who are part of that is to distinguish, as Heifetz says, between what is expendable about the past and what is precious about the past. Mm-hmm. Because I think newer generations are willing to respect, but not everything that we did.
Right.
So I think that's the conversation that needs to take place in communities.
What about the Browning of America?
Well, it's—I don't know. It's an interesting set of circumstances. I had really not had to come to terms with, or even really think about that issue as much until I arrived in Austin. And of course, as you know, that's a very liberal environment, and frankly, that Browning of America, as it plays out in Austin, unfortunately, sometimes it bumps into each other, and you know, and the challenges associated with that can be very difficult to resolve. But one thing for sure is that it you know, it entails having very candid and frank conversations.
Yeah. I was reading the other day, and it contrasted the Browning of America with the graying of America.
Right. And they're happening simultaneously, right?
Yes.
Rebecca, you've written a lot about the impact of technology and the use of technology in a variety of different ways. What do you think about the impacts of very rapid technological change on the way we think about community and local government?
I'm really interested right now in this concept, kind of the demarcation between smart cities, which tend to be super focused on sensors and infrastructure, right? Like, how many different things, how smart can our bridges be? You know, like the I-94 bridge in the Twin Cities that, like, puts down the de-icer so you never have black ice. That's fantastic. However, I feel in a way like a bunch of technologists just got a hold of cities and were like, we could turn your cities into robo-cities. And at the end of the day, cities are for people.
Yeah.
So there's some work being done in Sweden, a little bit of work here about smart citizens.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And what does that look like?
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
So like Kevin D'Souza, who's at ASU, he's on the Alliance for Innovation Board, he has written a really interesting paper that frames all the way that technology and citizen engagement are being used together. And it's the first paper I know of that has sort of framed these issues out in a framework that cities can use. Oh, if we want to accomplish this, this is how to help citizens use technology to do that.
Yeah, Kevin's got some really interesting work that's very important for us to think about. How about the fiscal crisis? The resource limitations that are going to exist probably for most of our lifetimes, I would suspect. What impact is that going to have?
When you say resource, are you talking about natural resources?
No, I'm really talking about the fiscal, the money. The revenue
FIS.
Systems and those kinds of things.
I know about that.
You got that one?
I recognize that. You know, it is obviously challenging. It hasn't been as challenging in Austin as it has been in other places. Austin, from a financial standpoint, when there's been economic decline, historically has been the last to feel in the first out, but still challenging nevertheless. I think that in terms of revenue policy and structure, that it's imperative that we rethink that, because I don't think it's sustainable over the long term. Now, what it becomes is obviously part of that conversation, and who knows what the outcome's going to be. I just know that this is not sustainable.
And what about, like, baby boomers as they age? Are they going to be willing to, you know, how much money will they have? How willing will they be to spend the money? And then I heard a revenue projection. I was in Colorado the other week, and they did a revenue projection, and they're doing the demographics, and they said older people don't spend as much money on goods as they do services, and what about sales tax on services?
Thinking about it another way, you know, a lot of the things we provide in terms of public service, you know, we address that part of the population often that has been marginalized historically, and I think more and more that we're seeing in terms of the merging of public, private, and nonprofit sectors, that they're recognizing the private sector, even a profit opportunity associated with addressing that part of the population, which may mean that cities don't have to be in those businesses, mm-hmm. thereby requiring mm-hmm. less in the way of revenue. So sort of, lessening some of that pressure.
Something popped out on the Next Big Things phase one sort of scan that we did around this, around innovative financing. And, of course, we all know about the, public-private partnerships. And two things were interesting about funding infrastructure in the future. The first one is this idea that when we fund big projects, we often don't take into account the O&M budget, the operations sure. and management. Mm-hmm. So we are going to have to figure out how to amortize that in because nobody wants to pay for maintenance. We're willing to kind of put up the money. And the other thing is how wide of a net can we cast for financiers? Like when Denver funded the last bit of its high-speed rail, investors from Spain were involved. Mm-hmm. It was a very nuanced and complex right. financing deal, and that's going to require a new set of skills within our cities wow. to be able to navigate all of that.
Yeah. So Shannon, one of the things Arlington is known for is the pretty high level of community engagement, and so I'd just like you to sort of react to Rebecca's earlier comment of sort of the high tech, high touch. How do you balance that in engagement processes that you guys use?
Yeah. Well, we try to balance it in our work every day and try to experiment with using different kinds of technology. One of the things that we're really exploring now is how can we leverage crowdsourcing? Part of our ongoing conversation with the community has been, and we've been hearing a lot of feedback, we can't afford to come in person, meaning can't afford mm-hmm. to time-wise come and stay till midnight at a public mm-hmm. meeting. And so we've really been trying to...
The staff, right, who's saying
yes, some of them.
As we're saying.
But I was at a meeting last week or a couple weeks ago with the business community and really having a great conversation. And that was part of the conversation. We're trying to run businesses and we want to be active and we want to contribute mm-hmm. and we want to be part of the conversation. But we don't have lots of hours to come to City Hall mm-hmm. or to a public meeting. And so we're really trying to experiment with how we can use technology to not only get feedback, but to have that online dialogue. And also use that as an opportunity to reach out to populations of our community mm-hmm. right. that we don't always hear from.
Right.
Well, and Shannon is doing something in her role as a business ombudsman that I think is pretty innovative mm-hmm. and we're going to have to do more of for the future of government. Can you talk a second about your role as the business ombudsman?
Sure. Well, there's three words or three different ways I would describe this role as an assistant county manager. I serve as an ambassador and liaison to the business community. I'm chief problem solver.
CPS.
With helping large businesses and small businesses if they're in one of our processes and having challenges. But what's the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and expecting mm-hmm. different results. And so mm-hmm. I also see myself as a key process improver or facilitator yeah. of seeing how we can improve our processes. Time is money for all of us, whether you're in the business sector or not. And so a lot of my time now is taking a look at how we can improve our processes.
So one...
I wanted to pick up on the engagement piece in general a little bit. And I think in a broad sense that we're improving opportunities to inform people. Mm. We're improving opportunities to solicit opinions and yeah. wishes. What I'm waiting for is an event where somebody hears somebody else talk and they get up and they say, you know what? I never thought about that. That's a good idea. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have very many forums where people are willing and encouraged to consider the consequences of their own views. Mm-hmm. We really do a great job of soliciting those views. Mm-hmm. I yes. think that's what we need to focus on.
So let's park that one, because I think that's an interesting question that we mm-hmm. need to think about as the design of the processes okay. itself mm-hmm. based on an outcome. One last driver that gets written a lot about is the concern about an increasing gaps between the have and the have-nots, and whether that's now structural to the extent that there we have large segments of our populations that can't participate in the 21st century economy. Is that something you think is going to be a big driver over time?
I think it is. I mean, it certainly is in Austin. I mean, what's come with all of the growth and development is a broadening of that divide. So much of the conversation here recently, as the newly elected officials were on the campaign trail, was affordability in Austin.
Right.
When I first arrived 7 years ago, I mean, one of the first terms that I heard was gentrification.
Yeah.
And it has a long history in Austin. And while the city has allocated a lot of dollars to things like, you know, affordable housing, you know, that's not really sufficient, hasn't been sufficient to close that divide. So we are, like many cities, struggling with that issue.
John, you've written a lot about the gap.
The gap.
Could you talk a little bit about what the gap is? And because I think, at least for those of us who work in local government all the time, I think that is one of the big sort of characteristics and drivers that
The gap really is what I consider the space between what's politically acceptable and administratively sustainable. So basically, the difference between, or the connection between what we want to do, mm-hmm. politically acceptable, and what will work. And in order to get anything done, there has to be a connection, and we have to bridge the gap. And I think distrust in government comes when we can't get anything done. Right? And so if the gap increases, it becomes more difficult, and there are all kinds of challenges that go with that. My sense is the gap is increasing, clearly at the federal level, state level maybe, but I think at the local level too, and it's driven by the idea of we have one set of forces that's homogenizing our lives. It's data-driven, analytical, and then we have another set of forces that's the politics of identity. That is emotion-driven, that's us versus them. Mm-hmm. And you contrast the two, and we just get this separation. And it used to be, if you look at that, you say, okay, here's politics, here's administration, there's the city manager, okay?
Yep.
And working the gap. But you know what I thought about the other day? When we draw those two arenas, we don't concern ourselves with how long that line is.
Right.
We've never done that. And I think, but if we graphically, if we say, look at, you know, if that line is really short, it's
right.
easy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If that line is long,
right.
it's harder, and now we need some help.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about how the help occurs, and we can talk about that a little later.
Yeah. So any other forces that you think are going to be the real powerful drivers of local government?
Can I geek out for just a second?
You can.
So I'm not a practitioner, right? I'm a futurist. And one of the things that, you know, futurists work on is this four forces model. You know, like there are categories of things that if these go wrong, no matter how much everything else is going well, your citizen engagement or your quality of governance or how good of an ombudsman you are, these things are going to blow everything up. And the first of the four forces and the most important one is resources. And so when we look at the politics around climate change in the U.S., U.S. is lagging Canada, certainly lagging the Northern Crescent of Europe in adaptation and mitigation policies and frameworks and measurements. And then I think what's most shocking that this research showed, the Next Big Things research showed, is that American cities are actually tied with African cities in their adaptation and mitigation policies. So we have a big delta in the U.S. especially around this piece. And if we don't get this piece right, you know, it doesn't matter how well we've robocopped our cities.
Right.
So your comment reminds me of a conversation you and I were having just yesterday, and we talked about resiliency.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's kind of a term that's out there and people are using it. And as I discovered recently, not everybody knows what it means, particularly in the context of cities. But it's an international conversation that's occurring. I wonder, because I have Rebecca's coming to my city to have conversation with the council and others on that very topic. Could you talk about that and maybe enlighten some folks that might be listening today about the nature of that conversation and what's meant by resiliency when cities talk about it?
Yeah, resiliency is the ability to not just bounce back from an external stressor, but to bounce back better. So, and there are some cities that do this well. Des Moines has done it twice with their 100-year floods. They bounce back even better. And then there are some cities who still talk about these floods that happened 35 or 40 years ago as a turning point. They never came back. So when you think about what makes a community resilient, there are sort of two threads happening in the international dialogue. One is this thread, and I think most American cities are on this thread. We're a little bit behind, which we just think about it as bounce back. But then there's the proactive piece, and I think that's what we're going to be talking about when we're together, which is you need to have your risk analysis figured out. Where are we threatened around resources? Where are we threatened around demographics and some of these other forces and trends so that if and when they happen, we are ready to go? And one of the key factors of resilient communities is social cohesion. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about the identity politics, you talk about lack of trust, those things make me nervous because if we don't have a cohesive response in our communities, we're not sometimes able to even bounce back, let alone get better.
So let's use that one as an example because I've framed some questions before about that the issues that really matter to people, the things that are going to be the important issues are things like you just described or even job creation or education or environment in the economy or those kinds of things. They're all multi-sector, multidisciplinary, intergovernmental. Those aren't things we're structured to do well. So could you talk about both the challenge and the opportunity that that creates?
Who wants to go? I mean, I think this is what is so exciting for the next generation.
You know, this is, to me, one of the consequences of the growing gap. Is the growing gap actually, if you look at it that way, it's kind of an invitation because we can't get it done ourselves. And so the nonprofits, privates, everybody comes in, right? This is powerful territory. And that what we're also realizing, I think what you've talked about, Bob, many, many times, that the problems we're dealing with now don't lend themselves to the decision makings, authority structures that we have. And that if we're going to respond, we have to find ways of, I had a colleague, Holly Gordell, she labeled it for me. She said, we have to be able to manage boundaries. And that's a new, it's not new, but it nevertheless, it's a label that I just think is wonderful. The idea of when do we raise the boundaries so we have some integrity? When do we drop the boundaries so that we, and how do you manage that both internally and externally? Because I think that really is a fundamental. And then the last point on this that I'll make is with all of the innovations that you guys have done, right, since 2008, how many changes in jurisdictional boundaries have we had?
So interesting. I've written a number of pieces around the question of boundary. Discipline, sectors. So to me, the challenge that we've got to think about is how do we maintain the community identity that we value so highly and get the scale necessary to deal with the issues that matter?
That's the issue.
And I think also another important piece of this is resiliency is a mindset. And I think it's a mindset that many of us don't have as much experience in. And I don't remember talking about this when I was in graduate school. I've learned it through experience throughout my career. And so how do we have that mindset through partnerships? And I think the partnerships of the past and today are going to be very different than the partnerships of the future.
You know, it's interesting listening to you use the term boundaries because it seems like everything that I see is pushing against boundaries and making them less clear. And we talk about managing boundaries, but it seems like innovation is found in places where people have crossed the line, where people have made connections that heretofore would have seemed unorthodox, right? And they keep making those kinds of connections and they take a step back and they look, and all of a sudden they see something that makes sense, yes. that resolves a set of circumstances, a social problem, a societal problem, right, in a way that nobody ever thought of before because it's disruptive and it changes everything. Mm-hmm. So when I think about that, and there are lots of examples of that, I don't know how to reconcile that really with managing boundaries.
Well, because you run into the politics of identity. So that if you're in a region, okay, regional government, you're going to do economic development, right? You're going to do it with individual jurisdictions that have branded themselves. What's the whole point of branding yourself other than you distinguish one from another, lends itself to some competition, especially if there's taxes at stake, potentially, versus the broader game of maybe we ought to look at ourselves regionally.
But you took the words out of my mouth because I think that formula, the one that you described, really is a failed approach, right? I mean, because the externalities resulting from economic development ultimately don't recognize the city limits of Austin, Texas.
Yeah, but who defines the problem? See, who's going to define that problem? So, for example, like in the Kansas City region, we're not only, we're by state as well as, you know, we got all these people go across the border. I mean, it's ridiculous. Oh, sorry.
It's fantastic, is what you meant.
Fantastic competition.
Right.
And then I say to myself, I say a couple of things. One is, how about we invent the concept of the regional citizen? How about we say, what do we have obligations not only to our individual community, but do we have obligations to the region? And then the other thing is, what if we redefine the game so the game is not an inter-competition, but we're actually competing against Omaha and Oklahoma City?
Mm-hmm. So John is a former mayor of Lawrence, Kansas, as well as his academic position. But I once had a mayor tell me that no regional citizens vote for me, right? And that's the problem, right? The identity also has an official status.
Yeah. But this is the difference between. Oh God, you get me going.
Wind him up.
No, you got to wind him down.
Which do you want?
Down. You know, this is the difference between a politician and a statesman. So the politician.
There is a difference between those two. Really,
the politician tells us what we want to hear. The statesman tells us what we can aspire to. Mm. And there are some mayors who are aspirational, and there are some mayors who are transactional.
So that's a good segue. Let's shift to the next big things that the statesman and others will bring to the table to help us deal with the challenges that we've just described. So. Are there any of those other than the one you've already shared with us? What are some of the things that are emerging from your research?
Yeah, well, I think just as sort of a PSA for foresight in your communities, the four big forces to think about are, number one, resources, which I already mentioned. Second, right behind it, is demographic. Right. Who is our society?
Right.
And to the resilience point, how well do they get along together? What are the tribes there? Demographics is third. The second one is technology. Mm-hmm. So how we manipulate our resources and make them more efficient. Like right now, technology is really lagging in terms of resources. We don't yet know how to really clean our air. We don't yet really have desalinization to the place where it's going to need to be if California really is in its last year of water. So, and then third is demographics. And the fourth is governance.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are a series of trends that are kind of shaping each of those. We've talked about several of them already. But I think, you know, one that, you know, we haven't talked about, but I would love to actually hear this panel's feedback on is, when you think about how we are going to have to work out of our silos, get on innovation teams, whatever that looks like, you know, if you were talking to somebody who's thinking about coming into public administration, when we are in this place where maybe the way we've always been structured isn't the way that we're going to be structured in the future, I see it as extremely exciting. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what you would say as practitioners to the next generation, because that is something around governance that is going to have to change. It is going to be a driver for change. What do you see coming? What do you tell the next generation to get them excited?
Well, you know, some of what I talk about is, we use this expression about, our employees are our most valuable resource. And I think when we say that, historically, we've been in the context of a particular area of expertise, what the job description says, and you put a person in that box, and their value is derived from that. And I think that's fairly narrow. And in our conversation, it's more like we value the whole person, because in addition to that particular expertise, you have X number of years of life experience in combination. We think that brings a range of wisdom. And so we say, when we hire you, we're hiring all of that. Bring all of that to work, because we think that's relevant to our mission, however you want to characterize mission. And when I think about that in the context of 13,000 employees, it feels like all kinds of things become possible when I think beyond that 13,000 employees and recognize that my workforce is larger than that because of what technology enables. All kinds of things become possible. So I think in that broader context of value and workforce, all kinds of solutions are and will be discovered.
Yeah, I've tried to capture the phrase a little bit that I wish I was 25 again, because this will be the decade or two decades of local government, because I think a lot of the forces we talked about, I think, are going to make the federal government and the state government have a great deal of difficulty dealing with the issue. So we're going to have to decide what's important in community, and so it's going to challenge our boundaries. It's going to challenge the identities, but we're going to deal with big issues that are important to people. And I think I think it's going to be really a neat opportunity. Now, is it going to be easy? No. Is it going to be challenging? Yes. Is it going to be huge opportunities for impact? Yes.
But see, I think, Bob, that if I look at it from look at the students, okay, as opposed to the newer employees, the students, there are loads and loads of service-oriented students. That's not the issue. My concern is that when they think about government, they think about what they see here, which is federal and state. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot inspiring there, okay? We have to expose them to the local scene. And when most of their exposure to their service motive gets through nonprofits, through the service learning opportunities and so on, and we need to find ways, local governments find ways to give access to those college students so they can see themselves what you all are doing and how exciting it is.
I think we also need to do a better job of sharing our stories.
Yes.
And it's not only for me working on the big projects that will have impacts for generations to come, but it's also the one-on-one interactions with a resident or with someone else in the community where you've been able to make a large impact, and sometimes you don't really realize. Mm-hmm. And the gift is when it comes back and that's shared with you later.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with that, because I was thinking before you spoke, what was it that drew me into the profession? Because my intent wasn't to become a city manager. In fact, I'm not sure I knew they existed when I was back in, the early days of college. But when I did this internship, working for a city manager, what I was struck by was the fundamental way in which cities impact the daily lives of people. And that just, that was profound to me. I think that fact is still true today. And it was, the being passionate about that, felt very, very natural. And I think that's the kind of stuff we need to talk about.
Mm-hmm. So just a question around a topic that's written a lot about the future is that increasingly there's an international or worldwide economy, there's a national economy, and there are regional economies. Mm-hmm. There are no state economies, right? Yet there's no state that has what I would call a city-state strategy. Mm-hmm. And yet that's the genesis of most economic activity around the world. It's the Singapores and the Hong Kongs and the Shanghais and Londons and places that are generating the activity, yet we don't policy-wise, we don't structure that way. How do you think regions are going to adapt to this sort of city-state world?
I have a couple of thoughts that are clinking around in my head, a couple of statistics that came out of the Next Big Thing research. The first thing is that, you know, everybody, when we talk about globalization, talks about the big cities of 10 million mm-hmm. plus, right? The Shanghais of the world. But when you look in developed countries, it's actually these mid-sized cities that mm-hmm. have under 2 million employees that are already generating 70% of our GDP. And those are actually seen as kind of the welterweights that are going to really, like, rock the economy. And what's interesting is when those cities start to take license with their own futures. Now, London is mm-hmm. a bigger example, but, like, the mayor of London has proposed this idea of a London visa, right? The idea being that he's going to work around Parliament, which has a specific number of visas that they allow each year, and he's going to create his own London visa. If you want to come and work in London, you'd apply to us for a visa, and we will hook it up for you. And that is part of his talent strategy. And so cities, I think, are starting to, cities, counties, these mm-hmm. regions are starting to work around these, these things. But then the other thing that's interesting from the business perspective, I'm thinking about you, Shannon, is businesses are like foregoing even having a state strategy or a countrywide strategy because we're just becoming a world of cities, a world of communities. So they're just developing community strategies,
yes.
not state strategies,
yes.
not national.
Yes, and we're having that conversation in Arlington right now, not only locally in Arlington, but also how can we develop more of a regional or region-wide strategy. In fact, we have started a conversation around how can we begin to develop a framework for prosperity.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. And that's not just for the business community. That's for everyone.
All citizens.
And so how do we begin to build that, and what does that look like?
You know, maybe part of this is sometime in the future, but maybe the immigrant base that we have is going to make a big difference here because they just have a broader perspective on the world,
mm-hmm.
right? And I was reading the other day where I think it was Sao Paulo or something. The city itself created a treaty with some other country. I mean, I don't know that.
I think Austin has several treaties.
But, you know, morphing the sister city concept into and really into something different.
Because I think that's becoming the economic engine, right?
So
you end
a
up
city,
with,
yes.
you
yep.
start
yeah.
to get those.
Yes.
So I'm going to be anxious to see if the mayor of London can get somebody out of Heathrow. That would be the that would be the real.
Well, I think once they have you, they don't want you to leave. So that's part of the strategy, Bob.
That works. There's still people there.
Maybe it's all the results of all the study abroad that kids mm-hmm. do yep. these days. Maybe that's going to have an impact too. Just internationalizing our perspective.
So my second question really relates around this boundary question, yeah. but also the work that we do is, I happened just to do some presentation around, and this is my provocative thought for the moment, is that what I wrote was that the agency or department is the dinosaur of the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That what we've created mm-hmm. is an organization of specialists yeah. in a world that requires an integration across those specialties mm-hmm. to be successful. And so how do we think about building organizations differently
mm-hmm.
To respond to what we have to do? We still have mm-hmm. to pick up the trash and do all those things, but the things that are going to move the community forward are things that are going to be these multidisciplinary, mm-hmm. interjurisdictional kinds of things. So how do we build this organization of the future?
Okay, do you want an answer to that question?
Yes.
Are you ready with an answer?
Yeah, I got all these things. I just pull them out of the hat, you know.
I know, we're going to get 3 credit out of this.
Hear that, everybody?
First of all, I think one of the things that's important for me anyway is to realize that people are driven to be competent. And I don't mean that as an average. I mean to demonstrate that they can do something that makes them feel worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And what we've done is we've channeled those competencies around disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the answer to your question is we have to rework the competencies. We have to rework what we value.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, it's like you all know, like when we talk about the gap and working the gap, if I do a workshop and I say, are some department heads better at working the gap than the other? than others? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. What does it take? Mm-hmm. Okay. Have you integrated those things into job descriptions, right, into mm-hmm. qualifications? And that's mm-hmm. the way we we're legitimizing the competencies, mm-hmm. right, and we're taking away the boundaries. And
but, you know, to rewrite the job descriptions, I mean, it seems to me it would require talking about things like ego and yes. leadership and all of those kinds yes. of things. Can you accept the reality that a good idea is a good idea regardless of where it comes from, even if it's not yours? Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, what kind of work is that such that you're balancing ego and leadership such that mm-hmm. you can give the things that you need to give in that environment that you're talking mm-hmm. about and receive the kinds of things you need to receive mm-hmm. without letting your ego get in the way? I mean, that yeah. it seems to me that's the context and yeah. the kind of environment yeah. and where people can feel safe. Yeah.
You know, there's a very tangible example, Bob, when you were in Hampton. You don't want me to remind you when you were in Hampton? No, you remember where you gave extra credit to, I mean, yeah. why don't you just talk about that?
This
That's
was,
a wonderful example.
The intent was, well, I was a city manager in Hampton, Virginia for a while, and the intent was to try to build this cross-boundary work in the organization. And so for the department and agency heads to reach the highest level in the evaluation system, you had to illustrate the contribution to say to the organization-wide goals and or the assist you gave to some other agency to achieve theirs. The minimum was running your agency effectively.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The extra credit was did you make some contribution outside mm-hmm. of your organization. So the idea was to try to make this the whole greater than the sum of the parts. Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is like the difference. I'm going to just make a jump here, okay? The difference, the transition you all have made in the way you talk about your team. Mm-hmm. You used to talk about a management team. Now you talk about a leadership team.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What happened? See, something happened, and I don't think they're synonyms.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
something happened, yeah. and you were at the forefront yeah. of that.
Well, I think that's actually a great example because you were incentivizing people
yes.
mm-hmm. to really collaborate with others. And so it's how do you create that culture of collaboration?
So the question I would ask then, given your example, is how did you get to that?
Well, it was a journey, obviously, but part of what
drink by drink.
But part of what I think John's point on the competencies was what I thought the leadership job was aligning the structures and systems and approaches to the values we wanted to create. So, if our value was cross-boundary work, then the structures and mm-hmm. systems had to support that, mm-hmm. and so. Who can change those, right? Well, it takes lots of people, but at the end of the day, the manager or folks in the leadership group have to endorse that we're going to align values and our systems.
So, but how did you do that? I mean, how much of that was directed on your part? How much of it was inspirational, motivational? Well,
I'll give it 30-30-30. Right? 30% right. inspiration, yeah. 30%... this is where we're going, okay. and 30% was, I think you unleashed uh-huh. something in people that they really wanted to
anyway,
do.
Anyway, that's yeah. exactly right.
But you forgot the other 10%.
What's that?
The other 10%.
Random thought is what the other 10%.
No. The other 10% is you weren't afraid.
True.
You weren't afraid
to
try.
I think there's the risk-averse nature you have to overcome.
Yeah, and I remember I was talking to Jim Keane one day, and it was at an ICMA reception, and I was the chair of the department, and I was bemoaning my woes, you know. And I said, and he looked at me kind of strangely, and I said, are you telling me you never felt like you were in over your head? And he said, no, but I didn't have the same expression on my face that you do.
That's a good line.
I get it. And so I tell students, I said, you know, it's not only your ability, it's not only your motivation, it's your willingness to accept responsibility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are you willing to do it?
So let me shift to a part. Maybe I'll ask Rebecca to start with this. I am increasingly interested in what I think is going to be one of the next big things, and that's how to have successful organizations where, and I'm going to use my count now, five generations in them, mm-hmm. and multiple systems of pay rewards and benefits. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the leadership challenges and I think opportunities, so one of the next big things is what do you do with this? Some people would say four. I would argue we're going to have people. I have a friend who just took a position as an interim city manager at 81.
Whoa.
I'm sorry, where was that?
At 81.
At 81.
That's was his. And, you know, he'll have 15-year-olds working in the recreation center. So, you know, I'm going with the five generations. And you know, we've had multi-generation things before, but then now we've got people with this benefit. Then the ones who've come in are now with this retirement mm-hmm. system. And so you got people working side by side, different generations, different systems of pay and benefits.
Well, I think, you know, just to be honest and to call it what it is, the next generation is not getting the same deal that your generation got.
Right.
You know, every deal is getting kind of worse and worse for people coming into local government because of just how things are right now. But I have to say that coming back to comp as like being the driver for people's motivation, I think at the end of the day, if you are saying, you know, we are trying to solve for this issue, who's in, right? Mm-hmm. If that vision is compelling enough and it is managed appropriately, nobody gives, you know, a rat's rear end about what year you were born. You know, are we in this together? And if we have that structured in the right way, then the leader's job is just to make sure that if Shannon's working discretionary hours to get this extra thing done in this sort of innovation task force, that she gets an extra half day off in the quarter or whatever is within your discretion to do. But I do think sometimes that when we put too much emphasis on the generations, when we highlight the difference, we take our eye off the work. And at the end of the day, the reason we're all showing up at Arlington County is because that's our employer and we have a job to do. Now, I do think there is a way to be respectful of all generations, especially what I perceive now is that as baby boomers are getting older and they are beginning to retire, it is very important that they are not feeling pushed out of the way. But it is very important for them to scooch their chairs over a little bit.
Sure.
It doesn't mean they have to leave the table. It just means they have to make a little more room. And I think, you know, for the next generation, the millennial generation, the folks born 81 to 2000, they are really the first generation for whom the term generation gap doesn't exist anymore because they mm-hmm. actually have many of the same values yeah. that their parents and grandparents did.
Yeah. Good. Mm-hmm. Anybody else have a reaction to you guys live with it every day?
Yeah.
Well, it is interesting. Yeah, your comment about it's getting worse and worse in terms of new people coming into the workforce compared to what the benefits and compensation of others. I'm not sure that those packages are relevant necessarily to the new workers today
because
I guess what I'm discovering is that, you know, they come to work for you. They're not necessarily making a commitment that's going to last long enough for them to become vested. You know, they come into the organizations. What I'm seeing is not looking like a traditional worker, not thinking like a traditional worker, wanting to make a powerful impact within a relatively short period of time that makes a difference, and then they may go. Mm-hmm. And in our environment, in my world, I think that needs to be okay mm-hmm. to do that. So what does that mean in terms of that all of that bureaucracy and that structure and how we thought about wage and compensation and all? It does apply to these people that have worked in the organizations for a long time, but it doesn't necessarily have to apply going forward, I don't think.
Yeah, I think portability means a lot more than
Yes, and I would say we're having a similar experience in Arlington. So, those that are coming in, and they're very upfront about it in terms of, you know, our plan is not to stay long, but while we're here, mm-hmm. we want to work hard, and we want to have a meaningful, we have an opportunity to make a meaningful impact.
Mm-hmm. And don't want to be limited to some sort of, you know, box, job description box. And frankly, again, as I said before, I think that's undervalued. And so I want to be able to take Bob, if he works in my organization, it doesn't matter that he's a lawyer or an engineer or he drives a backhoe, but it's the way he thinks about things that might suggest to me that we should put Bob over here with this group of people. It has nothing to do with what you do on a daily basis because you can add value.
Yeah.
And we're also seeing it beyond benefits, but it's also in how people want to work in their workspaces and the hours and the, you know, working from 8 to 5 in a cube. Those days are long gone.
That is a demarcation I'm noticing. Work is not where you go.
Yes.
It's what I do.
Yes.
That's right.
It's not a place.
Yes.
It's an outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So let me shift to another one that's written a lot about that I think there was a reference to earlier, and I'm going to call it the open source world, where, you know, whether it's an app or whether it's a delivery mode, we're going to be engaging where the workforce is only the window to the effort that gets done. So what's your reaction to what you see going on in both your organizations? Do you see that happening?
Do you have an example?
Well,
that you're thinking
I mean, obviously the hackathons are the easiest ones to illustrate, but I think what you're starting to see is you send the problem or the issue out and you invite the world to contribute to the solution. Mm-hmm. It's just not calling up the department head saying you got, you know, so it's a it's a way of thinking of a boundaryless, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Sort of. So That's right. The hackathons are the easiest ones to, because that's lots of people are doing them, but that's not certainly the only one.
And it certainly can go beyond that. I mean, part of the challenge we've had in Austin is, at least within the organization, is, you know, making data available,
right.
You know, because again, in that old paradigm, you've got departments with their data, you know, and they've protected it. In fact, some of them have root guards around around it, you know, and they don't want to expose it. And so, while we're encouraging that and pushing for that, you know, I don't want to become directive about it, but I may have to, because I view it as being that important in order to enable the kind of opportunity for solutions, Bob, that you're suggesting that becomes possible if you do that. Mm-hmm. So there are some cities that have been more successful in that regard than others, but I think that lends itself to solving some pretty important issues going forward.
I think, too, you know, if you make your citizen survey the raw data available, and you make things like police statistics the raw data available, and you put them out there, man, you're going to have some analysis, some really good statistical analysis that's going to come up with relationships that you never suspected existed.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a matter of, are you willing to make that data available? What data are you willing to make available?
Mm-hmm.
But particularly the citizen survey data. Mm-hmm. Because the reports you get, I've seen more than one. I mean, I could do the statistics on that, and I don't know statistics very well. But you should see some of the things that a faculty can do.
Right.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think the open data piece, you know, open government, government 2.0, whatever you want to call it, to me, you know, when you do futures work, the technology very often runs ahead of what society is ready to do. Mm-hmm. We can clone living things right now. Mm-hmm. Society is very uncomfortable with that, so we tend to slow it down. So the technology is there for this open data, but in a world where departments get there by what they know, setting that free feels very threatening.
That's right.
And so I think this technology and sort of the social structure of our city governments, these are going to help bring each other sort of into the next generation of workforce and maybe community that we want, but you do have to be ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just ask you to think about, Mark made reference that, I mean, I think there's been lots of work on how archaic the revenue systems are of local government, and I often made a joke that Virginia has one that basically was put in place to finance the French and Indian War. And yet the economy is changing so dramatically and the revenue systems don't. And so there's lots of conversations about how you structure financing from crowdfunding to offshore investors to public-private partnerships. How powerful do you think that's going to be over the next 15 or 20 years? Are we just going to like give up on the existing systems and go find these new ones? Are we going to revise and structure a new finance system for public investment? Or
I think some of both. Along the lines of what I was saying before, I think this new environment, we're going to find that solutions to things or the provider of things that cities have done historically, traditionally, we're not going to be in those businesses because those things are going to get solved in other ways, and that'll lessen some of the pressure that we feel from a physical standpoint. I mean, if I were to extend that all the way out, you know, very little that we would be left doing that we've done historically, you know, and that we'd be very streamlined. And, you know, our role would be more in terms of being conveners for things, brokers of resources, and bringing things together that enable other things to, you know, to happen.
Which, interestingly enough, was the original purpose of local government, actually, not a service provider, but a forum to decide what it is we needed to do together. So that's interesting.
What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think there's going to be, and it may be out of the infrastructure conversation, it may be out of the entitlement conversation, but I think we're going to reach a tipping point someplace where on the table will be what I will call intergovernmental tax reform. Mm-hmm. I do think there are some things that we can see on the horizon that will reach a severity level that you can't tinker on the margins with them, and that you'll have to do some different things. I mean, the obvious one is, if you're in the local government world, is the sales tax on internet transactions.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, the services versus making goods. Why should those be treated differently in the tax? You know, I mean, there's those things right now, as I described, it's easy to marginalize the argument about them, but at some point, somebody's going to show up and say, you need $4 billion to do an infrastructure replacement. And there's only one or two ways to get there. I think the creative things will be essential, but they don't replace an effective tax and revenue system. It's just that the systems are too big to do that. So I think we're, unfortunately, I wish I was wrong. I think we reach a precipice of a crisis that's going to require an action.
My fear would be that, yeah, there is a crisis, but what the states are involved, and the states limit home rule, and the states decide what's going to happen, and it's not to the advantage of locals.
It may not be, but you know, there's a piece that was written that was really interesting that sort of draw the inexorable conclusions of Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare, right? And so I drew a circle around and said, you're going to get a 21st century Federalist Papers out of this. Who's responsible for what?
And that's by 2030 that will be.
Well, yeah, I mean, it may take us three decades to have the conversation, but I think there are some things on the precipice that are just so significant that you just can't pass them by.
We'll have a partisan election to select the delegates to the Federalist Convention.
See, Kansas is... He lives in Kansas. That's all I want to say. I just want to remind our listeners that we're happy to take questions. We've got about 30 minutes left in the discussion. I know we did have one question that sort of showed up early, which was and I think we answered in part, but it was specifically about California and demographics. Does anybody want to react to what you think? I mean,
I don't know.
You don't know what's going to happen in California?
I think the question was about the aging population in California. And, you know, you just kind of created a nice dotted line to this, which is we are going to have to get this figured out. You know, at the time that Social Security was created, the age of 65 was selected, but people died at 62. You know, when we said the retirement age, it was set in the 1800s by the German general Otto von Bismarck. He set the retirement age at 65. Right. Most people died at 62, so it was really kind of like an exit strategy is what it was. And we, you know, and we are grandfathering this up. We're scooching it up just a little bit, but, you know, we, at the time it was created, there were 20 employees supporting one retiree. Worldwide, by 2030, it's going to be 4 workers supporting one retiree, and in this country, it's already under 3 for one. So California's going to face this. I think it calls right into question, do we tax services? Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned before we started today that retirees consume more services than goods. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think California has been the breeding ground for so much innovation, and this is going to be another place where we can maybe look to them for some mm-hmm. innovation in that space.
So we have another question. Is cross-sector collaboration the next big thing? What are the trends in local government collaboration with business and the nonprofit sectors?
I want to hear Mark talk about that, actually, because you have such a good perspective on the menagerie, you know, the blend of public, private, nonprofit already working together.
Well, I don't know that I can say more than what I've said. I guess I just do see a blurring, you know, of those lines. And I think that the private sector in particular, they're recognizing an opportunity to serve that portion of the population that's been marginalized over time, and that, you know, their profit-driven mission and their corporate values and serving some social need are not mutually exclusive, that those things do, in fact, mm-hmm. run together, and they're seeing opportunity there and making those kinds of investments.
So if I had to pick the horizon of 20, 30 years, I think I would make an argument that we're going to have a fourth sector, that we're going to have something that has some of the characteristics of the private sector, but the social missions of the nonprofit, and that we will commercialize that institution in a way, and because we have such a vibrant nonprofit sector, which is not normal in the rest of the world, that you can commercialize it because it has scale in a way that you could not do in the rest of the world. So my theory is what we'll have is this sort of fourth sector.
Is this kind of the social entrepreneurship?
It's
benefit corporations?
Yes, right. but sort of the next generation of that. And so think about if you were starting and I'm going to use the term, the Red Cross today. You might create a hybrid that it has a little commercial a set of commercial operations in a civic good. So, you know, if you've thought about it, if you started it today, it might look very different than what it is today.
You know, one of my reactions and concerns there is that I think we're in all these trends, we're actually with the collaboration, especially in the sectors, multi-sectors, we're going to be able to talk about democracy really well. I think we're going to be able to do that. Whether we can live it or not is another question.
It's messy.
And I think it's more than that. It's more than that. It's the idea that the government, the structures and the processes are built on democratic values and the competing democratic values. And what I want to know is a socially oriented nonprofit or profit-making, will they put as much value on individual rights as as the government does? Will they put as much emphasis on representation as the government does? What happens to these values? How do we convey these values? One person told me one time, he said, private sector is profit motive, the nonprofit sector is mission-driven, the public sector is values-driven, democratic values-driven. And my concern is, that's my concern, and I know, for example, that engineer who does right-of-way acquisition knows more about property rights versus majority rule than the most conservative ideologue in the world.
Yeah, and my hope is this would be, again, you know, when you try to, I respect Rebecca because you try to do something and say this is going to happen 20 years from now, you're probably likely to be wrong unless you're a demographer.
That's right.
is that this will be concentric circles, and there will be an overlap in the middle. The fear would be concentric circles where there's, as a friend of mine describes, where there's no sun, and they just bound into each other without any set of relationships, right? And that would be problematic.
Well, I think there are probably a lot of resources out there, people and organizations with money, non-traditional VCs that, from a value standpoint, have an interest in investing in things that are going to have some sort of positive social impact. You know, and I think that those resources are, you know, are going to create a, you know, some sort of a modified economy, you know, where, you know, the kind of metrics that, you know, the private sector looks at, or VCs that traditionally invest in private enterprise, the metrics are going to be different. I think those kinds of things are developing and providing the context that makes the kind of investments I'm talking about that result in solving social problems, you know, viable. And I think that trend's going to continue.
So the next question is regionalism revival the next big thing?
It hardly went away.
We've been talking about it, it seems, for a long
time. I'm sort of with the questioner here. I think we've done the easy things.
Yeah.
I don't think we've done the hard things. Mm-hmm. And I think if the impact is the question is, large scale public consolidations of jurisdictions, I'm not an optimist about that. But I do think the idea of collaborative work across boundaries is well within our reach.
I think they have to be real regions, though, because one of the things, you know, I've worked a lot with economic development, and sometimes they try to put together these regions, or maybe the Department of Labor has said, you're a region, and it doesn't feel like a region, like it's not a labor shed, and there's no reason that 26 counties are, you know, a region per se. I mean, maybe they are, but there has to be some human activity in that area that, to me, is a proof that there's a region. So I think regions constructed appropriately can be highly effective. It sounds like you're going to do a regional prosperity.
Well, we're starting the conversation in Arlington, but there's a broader conversation on how can we, as a region, position ourselves to be more competitive. Yep. So hopefully we can get them to blend.
Yeah.
So my pushback on is that the issue. Each issue has a different geographic perspective. And what we've tried to do is have a fixed boundary of the planning district or the whatever it is, which works for some things and certainly doesn't work for others. So sometimes you need 26, sometimes you need 3. And so to me, it isn't what I call structural. It's based on the outcome and the issue you want, right? And can we be flexible enough to define it around the outcome you want.
And what are the skills that it takes to manage those boundaries?
Absolutely. Because right now, and you live in training, in educating students to be interested in this, that's not really something that's inherently part of a, we teach a discipline, is what I describe.
Yeah, but we teach a lot about collaboration now. I mean, because the faculty know that this is, they watch what's happening, they see what's happening.
And well, that's good.
We have classes on collaborative this or that or whatever, yeah.
I wonder if it's going to take some change generationally, that some people are going to have to move out and others move in, and for the conversation to really become viable. I mean, because we've existed in this world of MPOs, Metropolitan Planning Organizations, and COGS, and all of those things. I mean, they've been around as long as I've been in this profession, and the fact of the matter is, in many instances, they operate in silos. You know, they don't work very well together. We have 2040 plans or strategic mobility plans. I mean, we have all of those things, but the truth is they don't really work that well. So mm-hmm. can we get be flexible? Can we move out of that?
I was thinking about this the other day, and I thought about the skills, you know, and I thought, okay, so what if we ask Mark to do an intern, to trade places, right, with the COG director for 3 months? And what if we ask, you know, whatever, Shannon to trade places
with Alexandria.
With yeah, see, what if we do those kinds
idea
of?
I traded, and she didn't come back.
But what if we did that? Or traded department
Ron
heads,
paid his
or
dues.
Did these kinds of things, so that we brought the perspectives in house more, just things like that.
Yeah. You know, I think there's lots of ways to make it easier.
Yeah.
But I mean, and maybe this is a question for you. There's still this place where people feel there's not the political will to do it because the constituencies that drive the political system aren't structured that way.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's where the idea of the regional citizen comes in.
Yeah, you know, we were talking about, I think, courage earlier. And so I think about this conversation and, you know, I guess in terms of what I'm about to say, I'm wondering how many of us, and the us is larger than us, I'm talking about my colleagues in this profession, would be prepared to stand in the middle of the room, you know, at a Chamber of Commerce-sponsored luncheon and have this kind of candid conversation about, look, guys, this doesn't work, and all of the things that we're talking about, what would happen? Mm-hmm. You know, what would happen if we as city managers and county managers and so stood in front of our elected officials, being courageous, fearless, right, you know, and had this kind of candid conversation, if we talked about the relationships between ego and leadership and how that is so vital to getting to the next place that we all need to be, what would happen? What if we talked like this in the presence of a bunch of young people that are in college, you know, and you're on the edge of your seat and you're wide-eyed and you're telling them about the opportunity and it's boundaryless, right? Mm-hmm. You can come in here. We're not going to put you in a box because we know you're on the edge of your seat. You just came out. Your head's full of all of this stuff, and we want you to use it. I mean, what would happen if we had those kinds of conversations?
Yeah. We'd have the next big things.
So, but you know what? What if instead of you having those conversations, the elected officials led those conversations?
Well, not just me, whoever.
No, but that's what I'm saying, though,
that's an equally valid question. Yeah. Will they?
Will they? But see, some will.
Right.
You know, and it's a matter of cultivating, you know, the ones who will. And say, okay, you know, this is a leadership.
But those of us who can should, I guess is part of what I'm saying.
I'm behind you on that. I think, you know, as I've been working with ICMA and with the Alliance, I really see this elected versus, you know, local government employee binary as not serving. I talked to a Zen master, actually, about this idea of who can stand at the intersection of the commons, what is best for all people, and the tribes who are just feel in some ways like they're tearing the commons apart. Mm-hmm. Who can do that? And my teacher said, either a dictator or a holy man. And I think anybody who can do that, doesn't matter if they're elected.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, or if they work in local government. That's who does it.
You know, we had a proposition back in November about, you know, the next transit investment, and it failed, right? And there are a whole lot of reasons I could talk about. I won't, because it start and stop, and then it failed. And I remember sitting in my office with an official who was saying, well, now that it's failed, and this person was opposed to it, now that it's failed, you know, what do we do next? And thinking about starting a conversation in regard to that question, and my reaction was, I am not interested in participating in another conversation like that,
right?
Because it's the same old one, and we've all heard it. You know, no disrespect to those that have participated in the past, but I'm interested in a different kind of conversation with other people involved, and if we can't have that, I see the outcome being the same again.
We have another question. will quantity and quality of water resources have an impact on local government?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So while the panel is pondering the response to that, I will tell you, I was asked to give a talk to one of the international water conferences, a huge conference in Singapore, and I thought I had a presentation that was reasonably profound, and the person who spoke just ahead of me, conclusion was the next world war will be fought over water, not oil. And I'm going, what do you say after that? So I think who has it and who doesn't is going to be an enormous issue worldwide, not just in the United States.
I think the crux of it is, you know, so it's water's a resource, right? So the first most important force. If you mess with the resources, all kinds of things happen. And, you know, quantity and quality are going to be incredibly important. There are linkages between drought, food shortage, and unrest. North Korea, Syria, Iran, all of these places of disruption. So but I think that the technology isn't there yet around water. So it's one of these places where technology is lagging resources, and who has the scale to invest in desalinization? Right. You know, this is going to sort of like your fiscal gun to the head. Yeah. This is coming, and it's coming quickly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the next question is, with the decline in public trust, how can local governments help build and restore trust and ensure transparency?
Oh, my goodness.
I'm going to go get some coffee.
That's a heavy question.
One of the challenges that we face, I think, is the carryover between the attitudes that people have towards federal and state. It's carried over without any empirical reference, you know, and that, so they're just sort of this overlay of why would you trust the government, whatever it is. I personally think that the fundamental prerequisite is, can you get things done? Mm-hmm. Can you get things done that collectively that people cannot get done individually? If you cannot, you cannot expect trust.
Yeah. I would add to that, in addition to delivering on projects and programs and services, also talking about the value of local government and the impact that we have in the community. So it's not only delivering on those results, but also through that, showing the value of how it's impacting those in our community.
So is that like a little commercial you do, you know, when you do have a public forum? I mean, because it almost seems like a talking point that you just have to, how do you do it?
Well, I try to take every opportunity, whether it's in a public forum or even on one-on-one interactions, small group conversations like this, and I always try to use opportunities to be able to share stories or talk about the value. It's even better when it comes from someone else. That's even more powerful when it's someone who has benefited or has been part of that. And so I wish we could figure out a way to
capture
that or help spread the good word of that.
You know what else? I think, now this is far out, but nevertheless, I think that jurisdictions need to develop vision statements and mission statements where you can't just plug in any city's name. I mean, it really needs to have character to it. So that really does capture, well, what is the spirit of this community?
The only pushback I would make on that is that all cities are made of humans, and all humans have a very similar basket of hopes and aspirations for themselves and their children.
Okay.
So, I don't know. I think to be relevant, you have to speak to those very humane.
Okay. So I have a very subversive suggestion here with strategic planning. Here's what we do. We develop a list of mission statements, vision statements, goals and objectives, and we say, pick your choice. And we just...
It's like a Chinese menu.
Yeah. What do you want? And we just, instead of going through the whole community thing, why do it? They're always the same. Just pick these off of this list, and you'll have your, and it only costs you $500. It won't cost you $50,000.
Has it really gotten so complicated? Sometimes I wonder about that. I mean, you know, I heard what you just said. We have to figure out. I mean, does it really get down to just, you know, shared values and belief about things and people and leadership that, you know, that's authentic? You know, it seems to me that's what people are looking for, that when you're talking to them or talking to me, I believe you, right? And that you act on that, you know, and you do what you say. And if you can't do what you say, and you take responsibility for that, and you even offer an explanation why, even if you make a mistake, it's the same thing. And that really sounds almost like it's too simple to be a significant part of the solution. But I think it is. You know, it's. I know it's a feeling that you sometimes get in a room when you're talking to someone like that, and you're looking them in the eye. You know, you can tell whether or not they believe you, and I think that cuts through a lot of the other stuff.
Yeah, I think I know some of you have seen. I got curious on this public trust question.
What'd you find out, Bob?
Well, interestingly enough, and I will do the short version of this. So I looked at every referendum in the United States from November 2010 to January 1st, 2013. And I picked November 2010. That was the Tea Party election in Congress. So I took it as that moment of sort of anti-government. And then we were still not out of the depths of the recession. So I was trying to say the sort of the worst politics and the worst economic environment. And I looked at referenda that either authorized an expenditure of money or new power or new revenue source for local government. So those three categories. In that period of time, 76% of those in the United States passed.
Passed.
So what I was trying to speculate is what built the trust that in this sort of time they passed.
Yes.
I mean, there were three predictive criteria. So the first was there was a specific use of the money. The use of the money was generated by a substantial public engagement process. It wasn't, I got a good idea, I'll sell it to you. Right. It came as a set of priorities that were derived from the community. Yeah. And there was an entity that was a good public steward. So the steward, you know, that was a local government, a school district, or a special authority that had a long track record of being a good steward of the public's resources. If those three things existed, it almost always passed.
Wow. That's good to know.
And so what I was arguing is there's a formula here on trust. It was engagement, transparency, accountability, and performance with an overlay of ethical behavior produces public trust.
That's great.
And if those things... You can move the needle on those things. Yeah. So it's not like, well, I don't know how to do this. We know how to do some of this.
Can I have your autograph?
Sure, right there. So, all right, we got a few minutes. Let's take at least one more question. Please talk about identity politics and the hidden discussion of our time. All right, John.
That sounds like one
don't
for
get
John.
Me started. Yes. Don't get me started.
Here we go. You got 3 minutes.
Okay.
It's like a public hearing.
Okay. So, very interesting book. His name is Dominique Moissy, M-O-I-S-I. It's called The Geopolitics of Identity. It's very interesting. Mm. And he says, we've moved from focus on ideology, capitalism, socialism, communism, to a focus on who we are, identity. And that is fueled by emotion. And then he says there are three cultures of identity: cultures of fear, cultures of despair, and cultures of hope. He says cultures of fear especially invoke an emotion of us and them and what happened and this and that. And the danger of the politics of identity is there's no analysis.
You know, there's no self-reflection. It's, are you for me or are you against me? And it's the whole thing, as you all know, only listening to what you want to hear. And that's the big danger. And in my mind, and then, and the precursor to that is, are we afraid? Are we a culture that's becoming afraid? What are we afraid of? But if we're a culture that's becoming afraid, expect more us and them. At the same time, we're trying to build this inclusiveness, and that's a tension, significant tension.
So one other aspect of it that I've always struggled with is because of just ubiquitous nature of information is, on the one hand, we seem to be atomizing communities. That is, it's down to the cul-de-sac or the, you know, and then at the same time, we're creating sort of global citizens, right, who know stuff about things that are going on for the first time, literally in other planets and all over the world. And there's like, we're missing the attention to the something between those two things. And I'm perplexed with how to draw the community definitions. I mean, we have, so I sent some people out, actually, who asked me about this. I said, I think we need to have a robust and interesting study of soccer in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
Youth soccer is the most interesting community. It's organic. It has now structure to it. It crosses all kinds of... So how do we create that community? Because if we could replicate that in today's world, that model...
And it just cropped up.
Right. So, you know, somebody said, well, how do you get information out? I said, if you don't... If one of them isn't the soccer field on Saturday and Sunday, you are missing a huge part of the of the community. So the net. Let's see. We have one more. We're going to take it. We got about 5 minutes. Does the panel think social impact bonds are the next big thing for local governments?
I don't know what they are. What is it?
Well, I think again. I think we've been having the conversation. I was alluding to it earlier. I mean, one way. Solutions to social problems have been financed with this whole concept of this kind of bonding. And I was suggesting earlier that there are a lot of resources, the non-traditional VCs that have a lot of resources, but they're looking for those kinds of opportunities, opportunities or solutions that address social needs.
I think they could be a next big thing in the right community, right? So. You know, we've seen some transportation plans that have been financed in part by private sector because they see that as being a direct benefit to their workforce. It's a retention strategy for them. So I absolutely think it's going to be in the basket of financial possibilities.
So my view of social impact bonds is they will not be the next big thing, but they will be the bridge to the next big thing. I think they are a platform for us to think about non-traditional ways of engaging private sector and public sector dollars in a way blended to a project or an idea. I think they're clunky. So they're sort of like 1.0. If you look at them just from a finance standpoint, they're not the cleanest way to do stuff. And so I think it's a bridge. If it has some traction, I think it's a bridge to the next the 2.0, which I think is probably, or a 3.0 might be something that is the next big thing.
Definitely in the developmental stage. In fact, I think they're trying to create a sort of a ratings criteria now. Like you have Moody's and Standard & Poor's and Finch and all of that stuff. And I think there's a similar kind of thing now for these kind of social impact bonds.
Yeah, and I think within the rating agencies, they're struggling with how to rate these sort of blended things together in a way, and what's the risk exposure kinds of things if you're part of a larger finance package of things. So I think we're at that experimental stage where you have to sort of think through it, and then we'll think about the things that work and those kind of things. So we have about 2 minutes left. So I want to just offer the panel any concluding sort of observations of the conversation before we sign off.
you know, we the next big idea, I mean, we've talked about it here, and as a board member on the Alliance, we talk about it there. And when I listen to those conversations, it almost feels like you're waiting for someone to articulate what the next big idea is, you know? And it strikes me that that's not really the answer. I mean, it could be anything, but it feels like what's more relevant is what is the context and the environment that that you know, that needs to be created in order to make, enable the next big idea or ideas.
Well, I'll tell you what, I don't think we're going to get better concluding comment than that one. So that is extraordinary. Thanks, Mark. I want to take just a second to thank my fellow panelists for this conversation and devoting your time to it. Thank you very much. I want to thank the Alliance for Innovation and the Alliance for Innovation Board of Directors for thinking of the idea of a next big thing project. And I want to thank ICMARC, who provided the funding for the Leading Ideas series, that we wouldn't be able to do that without their contribution. And so our hope for this is that those of you who were able to participate with us today certainly got some benefit of the conversation. We hopefully it's useful in your conversations in your organization and communities. We're also going to archive this and hopefully be able, you can download it at some point in time, and it may be used for others who didn't get a chance to participate today. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you.